People are actually losing their homes and asking to rent in our apartments.
The biggest obstacle is, of course, lack of funds.
We think we've helped 58,000 people.
We're constantly having a greater demand for affordable housing.
Welcome to the Affordable Housing Podcast, brought to you by Eden Housing.
For several years, news hasn't been good for the affordable housing industry, at least in terms of funding on the federal, state, or local level. In California, it's been double trouble, with the elimination of the redevelopment agencies, which had helped local governments invest $1 billion a year in affordable housing. On the federal level, we've seen the virtual elimination of capital funding for Section 202 senior housing and the HOME program. Thankfully, we still have the Federal Low Income Housing Tax Credit Program, which creates tax incentives for corporations to invest in affordable housing. Hi, I'm Joanne Green, and welcome to the Affordable Housing Podcast, brought to you by Eden Housing. This month, as we look toward President Obama's second term, we'll be focused on the current state of federal housing policy and the challenges we face now and likely in the foreseeable future. Our guest is David Gassen, Vice President and Director of Corporate Communications at Boston Capital, a diversified real estate investment and advisory firm serving clients nationwide and internationally. Mr. Gassen has been with Boston Capital for 17 years. He's also Executive Director of the Housing Advisory Group, an organization founded in 1993 to advocate on behalf of affordable housing issues in Washington. David's responsibilities include representing the industry's housing and tax agenda before the administration and Congress, and regularly meeting with legislative leaders and senior legislative staff. Mr. Gassen is regularly invited to address conferences and industry groups across the country on issues related to housing, tax policy, and the national political environment. Prior to joining Boston Capital, Mr. Gassen served on the staffs of Congressman Richard Gephardt and Senate Majority Leader George Mitchell. He is no stranger to the workings of Washington. David, welcome.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Absolutely. But the workings of Washington have gotten worse over the years, have they not?
Joanne, to be honest with you, everything changes. It's cyclical. I think people that I worked with in Washington when I was there 17 years ago and prior would say that it was a different environment than it is now. I have plenty of friends who still work on the Hill and they love it. So things change. The environment changes. But the work goes on, so I think you adapt. So it's not the same place it was, obviously, when I was on Capitol Hill, but we still managed to get things done.
I like hearing that. You know, it is tough to talk about federal funding today without addressing the whole notion of fiscal cliffs and their effect on housing programs. Can you give us a little background on why we have these so-called cliffs?
Well, sure. I mean, through Congress doing or not doing its work or trying to do its work, they established a number of deadlines, or they gave themselves and the president, the administration, a number of deadlines. And every now and then, and this is one of those situations, the deadlines are all coming to fruition at the same time. Everybody recalls what we went through with New Year's, and I certainly do, because I was up until wee hours in the morning on January 1st waiting for the Senate to vote on the tax cut bill. And it was ironic and sad that my friends and I and colleagues in the industry were emailing each other around 3 o'clock in the morning on January 1st, congratulating ourselves after the Senate voted, because as we all know, that vote included the extension of the 9% fixed credit. But we still have deadlines in front of us. Some of those are the budget. The Congress passed a continuing resolution to fund the government because they could not pass a budget itself. And the budget runs out for the government on March 27th. In addition, there's the sequester. As part of the tax cut package that they did on New Year's and a few days after that with the House, they pushed off the sequester until late February, early March. And if you want to get into more details on exactly what the sequester is, we can do that. And then we have the debt ceiling. The debt ceiling is going to hit the federal government, where they're going to have to vote, the Congress is going to have to vote to raise the debt ceiling about the same time, the end of February or early March. So all three of these perfect storms are going to hit around the same time. So once again, we find Congress and the administration butting up against deadlines and holding the future course and the economic course of the country and, to a large extent, the world economy in their hands.
And more sleepless nights.
And more sleepless nights, yeah.
So, David, what do you see as the potential impact that the cliff will have or is having already on the HUD budget? Are there particular programs that are more or less at risk now in the housing budget?
I tell you what, Joanne, that is my greatest concern. As I talk to folks both in the industry and friends on Capitol Hill and folks in the committees that have oversight over the HUD budget, there are a few things that have happened, especially with the new Congress. If you go back to the 112th Congress, which is the previous Congress, they passed the sequester as part of the Budget Control Act when the super committee, and I don't want to go back too far unless you'd like to, could not come to an agreement on how to address the deficit. And the stick in those negotiations was the sequester, $1.2 trillion in cuts to the federal budget. Well, realistically, no one, whether it was the Democrats, the Republicans, the House, the Senate, the President, no one thought they would ever actually do the sequester, that they would inflict these cuts upon the federal budget. The tax compromise comes along at the end of the year, beginning of the year, and they pass that. The new Congress comes in, but now the difference is this. You actually have members of Congress, mainly the Tea Party folks and some members of the Republican Conference in the House, who now say, no, let the sequester go through. We need to get government spending under control, and this is the only way to do it, and we're in favor of going ahead and having those cuts, you know, come to fruition, which is very scary. If you look at the HUD budget alone, it would be a $3.6 billion cut to the HUD budget. $2.2 billion of that would be out of the voucher programs. So that is substantial, and it would inflict real pain across the board on HUD programs, but specifically to the voucher programs.
Is it your sense that we're ever going to see an increase in key production programs like the HUD Section 202 Elderly Program or the HOME Program?
Well, you know what? Everything is cyclical. The economy is down right now. The world economy is down right now. We're in better shape than the rest of the world is, but obviously we're struggling. But you know what? It'll come back. I mean, as everybody knows, and won't be any surprise, the economy will come back. And it will be robust again. It is at that time where, depending on who we have as our advocates in Washington, and if we have friends in the White House, if we have a favorable administration and folks running housing and urban development, that they would propose a budget, along with their colleagues on Capitol Hill, that would increase funding to HUD programs. But it will not be before that. We need to see the economy more robust. We need to see a healthier economy and the deficit more under control before we could probably count on any increases in any of the HUD programs.
Beyond HUD, the tax credit program has been a huge source for spurring production in affordable housing. David, can you briefly describe how the tax credit works and why it's so important for affordable housing development?
Absolutely. And you know, it sounds complicated. It's really not. We always joke with people because Section 42, which is the low-income housing tax credit, Internal Revenue Code Section 42, is the largest section of the tax code. Right there, people start to get intimidated. But on the face of it, it's not that complicated a program. And this is how it works. The federal government issues tax credits to each state based on the population of their state. And it's a per capita tax credit, which for this year, I believe, is going to be $2.20 per capita. So the translation is this. For every person in the state of California, the federal government is going to give California $2.20 in tax credits. So the state gets that on an annual basis. What the state then does is they come up with something called a qualified allocation plan. And what that does is that it is the state's roadmap or blueprint for how they want those tax credits, or to be more basic, the affordable housing in the state to be dedicated for that year. So California might say, we need more seniors housing, we need more housing for families, we need veterans housing, we need special needs housing. They will decide what kind of housing they need and to a large extent where they need it. And they will come up with their qualified allocation plan, whereby developers of affordable housing will look at this, and they will then come up with plans to build these developments and try to score points within the QAP. And that's how you get tax credits. Whoever scores highest in the QAPs is who then is awarded tax credits by the state. It is a little more technical than that, but that's a basic understanding of how the program works. I mean, anybody who just is not looking to delve into the program, but they want to kind of understand how it works, that's how it works.
No, that's a perfect level of detail. Tell me this, though. When the recession first hit, the tax credit market was pretty much stalled. Has it come back? Are there now new investors in the space?
Yes, obviously the industry felt the downturn, as did the rest of the economy, because we lost our two biggest investors in affordable housing, which was Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae. They dropped out of the program as equity investors. Now, the production in the program continued, though, and credit for that largely goes to those investors and financial institutions which continued to invest in the program, and a program that we got thanks to Congress in the Recovery and Reinvestment Act, which was the TCAP program, Section 1602. And what this did was it actually provided a federal grant to the states to make up for the equity that was taken out of the marketplace when we lost Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. So production continued. Investment did fall off, but the production of the program continued. Now, that has since rectified itself. Obviously, the TCAP program was a one-time program through Congress, which expired and was not renewed 2 years ago, I believe. But the investment in the program is back to where it was before the economic collapse. We're back to an $8 to $11 billion program. And that's a combination of economic investor, financial investors, and institutions. CRA investment is a large portion of that. So the program now is humming along. But again, I want to emphasize the production in the program never really fell off.
All right. That's good to clarify that. Now, the tax credit program focuses on rental housing, right?
Correct.
So how does rental housing demand relate to the foreclosure crisis? There have been some suggestions that the recent foreclosure crisis has solved the affordable rental housing challenges. For the regions served by Eden, this is not the case. We have more than 9,000 households on our waiting lists, virtually no vacancies at this point. Can you talk about this situation in other parts of the country and how the foreclosure problem has impacted the demand for affordable rental housing?
Well, I can't talk specifically to specific areas in the country. I can talk to the myth that you just discussed in regards to the foreclosure crisis solving the affordable housing. And this is largely put out there from folks who, number one, don't understand what affordable housing is. When they think affordable housing, they literally still think single-family housing or home ownership or people who go and they live in a single-family home. They don't. And this is common that we find when we go talk to Congress and we educate them, that they just don't understand, a lot of them don't understand what is affordable housing. And we have to explain that to them. The foreclosure crisis didn't do anything to solve the affordable housing problem. If anything, it exacerbated it because the lists have grown of people who now need affordable housing. So it's exactly the opposite of what people, again, who do not understand what the crisis is and the situation is with housing, actually, that it's worse now than it was before in regards to the people who need affordable housing. And as anybody who's a practitioner in the industry knows, we will never meet the demand for affordable housing in this country. If you just look at the low-income housing tax credit, in a good year in the economy, we maybe produce, give or take, around 70,000 units a year. The Center for Joint Housing Studies at Harvard estimates that there are around 5 million units. There's a 5 million unit need for affordable housing. Again, we're doing 70,000 units. They need over 5 million units to meet the demand for affordable housing. So that's a myth in regards to what the foreclosure crisis has done. If anything, it's just added to the list of folks who need to find what we produce.
David, let's go back to the budget situation for a moment. Swirling around in all of the fiscal cliff conversations are references to tax reform. Mm-hmm. Do you think our elected officials are talking about individual income tax reform, corporate reform? And in your view, what types of tax reform would create the most savings?
Okay. Well, when these folks talk tax reform, they're talking comprehensive tax reform. They want to do both on the individual side and the corporate side. They want to do soup to nuts. And that's fine. You know, we support tax reform because we, along with most other people, agree that the tax system is far too complex, could be simplified, and there are things within the tax code that maybe do not serve the greater public good, that should not be a preference within the tax code. What the fact is this, though. There is much more money on the individual side in regards to tax revenue that comes in from individuals than corporations. The estimate is that about, of all the tax revenue that's collected by the government, only 15% or so is corporate tax revenue. But everybody talks about corporate tax reform, lowering rates down to about 25% or so. They would like to get this done. It is going to be complicated, though, by the maelstrom they created for themselves in all of these budget issues hitting around February and March. They have to come to an agreement on how they're going to solve the sequestration, the debt ceiling, and the budget. And that's going to complicate the Tax Writing Committee's abilities to really tackle tax reform. Now, Chairman Dave Camp of the Ways and Means Committee is set on doing this. He has been determined for a long time, as have his predecessors, to be honest with you, to do tax reform. Chairman Max Baucus of the Senate Finance Committee, too, would like to do tax reform. And he and Dave Camp, actually, despite the fact that Dave's a Republican and Max is a Democrat, have a very good working relationship, talk constantly about this and would like to come up with some way to do tax reform. It is going to be a difficult task to do because, in my opinion and from my experience, you need to have compromise. I mean, it's like anything else for Congress to get things done. There has to be compromise. There has to be a willing to sit down at the table and find out what works, what doesn't work, come to an agreement on it, and come up with a final product that a majority of the House and the Senate, potentially a supermajority in the Senate, can agree upon. And that's going to be difficult for them to do. Now, that being said, folks involved with the low-income housing tax credit, the new markets tax credit, the historic tax credit, all these tax credits that we use as our production programs, I mean, we encourage them, and we're serious about this, that they need to advocate for this program like there is no tomorrow. Because having worked on the Hill, I can tell you, it's incredibly easy for Congress, especially a Congress that is not educated on a specific issue, to take legislative action that would affect that issue in a detrimental way simply because they don't understand how the program works. And that's why we've gone to such great pains to educate Congress and continue to educate Congress on what the low-income housing tax credit does.
One of the biggest housing tax breaks for individuals is the mortgage interest deduction. Congressman Ellison has a bill that would limit that deduction and direct some of the savings to housing programs. This is a very important tax break for homeowners here in California. Can you talk about how much this deduction costs and what you think might happen if it's limited? Would it be possible for savings to be redirected, or would it just actually be used to help reduce the deficit?
Yeah, well, boy, that's, you know, that is on the top of everybody's list in regards. It's number one, it's the easiest one because everybody knows what it is. There are so many deductions in the tax code and credits, and the one that seems to have the best name idea, obviously, is a mortgage interest deduction, because if you own a home, it one point or time, almost everybody's taken advantage of it. I believe, if I remember correctly, the five-year cost on the mortgage interest deduction is somewhere around $650 billion. It is the third largest deduction in the tax code. So there is incredible savings to be had by looking at the mortgage interest deduction. There also seems to be bipartisan support for doing something on mortgage interest deduction. And again, if they are looking to trim the code, raise more money to help attack the deficit, you have to go after those programs that cost the most. So this is one of the reasons why the mortgage interest deduction is in the crosshairs. Now, we're not supporting or advocating for anything. This is not our bailiwick. We don't deal with the mortgage interest deduction. But conversation on the Hill largely centers around limiting the deduction, primarily to primary residents, you know, one home. So you potentially, you know, and again, there's nothing is set in stone yet. They haven't drafted legislation, but you might see a day where you would not be able to use the mortgage interest deduction on second homes, on boats, on aircrafts, on ancillary things. It would only be the primary residence. The other thing they potentially are looking at doing is capping the deduction. The most popular figure, because it's the round number right in the middle, is $500,000. So you would get to deduct your mortgage interest up to the first $500,000 in the home and nothing above that. So there's a lot out there in regards to the mortgage interest deduction. But I just will say that if they do accomplish something, there is bipartisan support to look at the mortgage interest deduction.
In California, we've had pretty broad support for the low-income housing tax credit. Last year, Congress made some changes that were very helpful, including the 9% fix and military housing extension. Do you interpret these changes, David, as a sign of national support for the credit?
Well, I always worry about when anybody says national support. Obviously, we'd love the credit to have national support. I think you'd have a hard time going into a diner in any city and mentioning it and anybody knowing what the loan capacity tax credit is, which is why our focus is largely obviously on Congress and elected officials at the state and local levels. They're the ones who really see the benefits of the program. Now, getting back to your initial point, Joanne, on the fact that we did have a huge success at the beginning of this year in getting an extension of the 9% fix. And the reason for that was folks in the industries took the time to educate members of Congress, to get them out to their properties, to see what the program is actually doing in their communities on the economic development side, on the social service side, on providing wonderful housing. I mean, that's the other thing. People, again, elected officials and people in general have no idea what affordable housing is. They have an idea of what they think it is. But when they actually go to an affordable housing property, they're dumbfounded because this is not what they thought affordable housing was. The reason that, and that's the success that we've had in the program, and that's why we made it into the tax bill at the end of the year and the beginning of the year that was passed, was because Chairman of Ways and Means and the Chairman of Select Revenues, Pat Tiberi of Ohio, and the folks in the Senate have an appreciation for the program and what it does. So we need to continue that. That's something the industry is constantly focusing on. The consensus core group that I'm a part of is getting our folks to advocate for the program and doing it at the local level. These elected officials need to see what the tax credit does at home. If they feel it, if it is part of their being in regards to what's going on in their district, and when that vote comes up and someone says loan compensating tax credit, and they can say, oh, wait a minute, I've been to those. They're awesome. I have them in my district. I support that program. That is what will maintain the loan compensating tax credit as part of the tax code and ensure our future. But that's what it's going to take for us to get there.
Education. So if we've learned anything in California from the redevelopment laws, it's that we must remain vigilant in our efforts to promote awareness of the importance of affordable housing to our elected leaders. Is there anything our listeners can do, David, to make sure that programs like the tax credit stay in place?
Well, absolutely. And again, it's advocating on behalf of the program. If you are familiar with the program, work with the program, live in one of the communities, I'm going to give you a website. It's rentalhousingaction.org. And that is the consensus group site that has all the tools anybody will need. It has state fact sheets, so you can pull up the state of California and see what the tax credit has done in the state of California since it was created back in 1986. And we have those for every state. We have letters to members of Congress. We have whatever legislation might be out there, which we're in the process of potentially drafting new legislation once again to make the 9% credit and the 4% credit permanent parts of the program. All the tools are there. Site visits. How do you do a site visit? How do you get a member of Congress to come out to a property or the Senate to come out and see a property, which is pivotal? This is what's key. So rentalhousingaction.org is the clearinghouse where folks can go read about the program, learn about the program, and find out how they can support the program.
David, thank you so much for your insights today.
It has been my pleasure.
Once again, that URL is rentalhousingaction.org. David Gasson is Vice President and Director of Corporate Communications at Boston Capital and Executive Director of the Housing Advisory Group. I'm Joanne Green. For more information and to check out prior episodes, please visit edenhousing.org.
SmarterPodcasts.com. Delivering sound advice.